I declare the meeting open at 5:30 p.m. I welcome councillors, management, members of the public in attendance to the City of Melbourne. We respectfully acknowledge that we are meeting in the traditional land of the Kulin Nation. This place is now known by the name of Melbourne. Melbourne is one of the most multicultural cities in the world and a significant meeting place. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place and a location for events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. Could I take this opportunity to notify members of the public that the meeting is being recorded and will be made available on the City of Melbourne's website before close of business tomorrow. The unconfirmed minutes of this meeting will also be available from the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. Should there be any queries relating to the conduct of the meeting, the documentation or the submission process, please speak with a member of the Council business team after the meeting, and may I ask that all mobile phones be turned off for the duration of the meeting. The agenda comprises three reports from management and six items of general business. No apologies have been received. I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than six members voting in favour, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. If any councillor has either a direct or indirect interest as defined in the Local Government Act 1989 in relation to a matter to be considered by committee, please disclose the type and the nature of the interest prior to consideration of the item. May I call on a councillor to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 78 held on Tuesday the 5th of April 2016. Councillor Wood, Deputy Lord Mayor, I'll put that motion. All those in favour? That's unanimous. Thank you. Are there any matters arising from the minutes of the previous meeting? In that case, as at 3 p.m. today, the following submissions were received in accordance with the Council's conduct of meetings, Local Law 2010. In relation to Agenda Item 6.1, that's 185 Rosslyn Street, West Melbourne, a request to speak from Robert DiCintio on behalf of the Trinity Property Group. In relation to Agenda Item 6.2, Ministerial Referral, which is 24 to 46 of Beckett Street, Melbourne, a request to speak from Hugh Smythe on behalf of SJB Planning. In relation to Agenda Item 6.3, Options for a Hoddle Grid Heritage Review, requests to speak from Tristan Davies from the Melbourne Heritage Action Group and Felicity Watson on behalf of the National Trust of Australia in Victoria. And items of correspondence from Michael Kennedy, William Allen, Bill Cook, Yolanda Leonardi, Greta Bird, Tristan Davies and Felicity Watson. In relation to Agenda Item 7.1, a notice of motion from Councillor Watts, greater transparency in electoral donations, a request to speak from Tony Penner, and items of correspondence from Bill Cook, Yolanda Leonardi, Julie Harrison and Tony Penner. In relation to Agenda Item 7.6, notice of motion from Councillor Leppett on Flemington Road, Lemon Scented Gums, requests to speak from Chris Thrum, Joe Edmonds, Julianne Bell, Christine West, Dr. Anne Reid, and Felicity Watson, and items of correspondence from Ray Carling, Chris Thrum, Josephine Lang, Cheryl Saunders, Kay Oddy, Ian Baker, Joe Edmonds, Julianne Bell, Yolanda Leonardi, April Newton, Bob Moore, Sue Freeland, Marge Jungworth, Christine West, Barbara Champion, and Jan Thomas, and Kevin and Denise McNamara. Is there anybody here who'd like to address us whose name I have not read out? Yeah. No, just tell me which item.
Oh, sorry. No, I've got a question.
Not yet. I'll get to that. And your name? Thanks, Michael. Thank you, Michael. Now, I'm sorry to delay you a little. At the commencement of each meeting, we provide a 15-minute period to allow members of the public to ask us questions. Questions should not be greater than 90 seconds in duration. This is not the time to make submissions. Submitters will be invited to address the committee at the time the relevant agenda item is considered. Please. Bill, please go to the lectern.
Okay, my name is Bill Allen. I'm a resident of Regency Towers, and I work with a group called the Wesley Historic Precinct Action Group. We're very dismayed at the... this is by way of introduction. We're very dismayed at the decision made by council and the minister to build the monstrous building on the Wesley site. Now, my question is very simple. Can the Right Honourable Lord Mayor categorically rule out that he or his team have solicited or received funds from Leighton, CIMIC, Charter Hall Group, or any other associated entity or persons linked to these developers? That's my question. Could I add?
No, the answer is yes. I can rule it out.
Well,
I'm sorry if that takes the air out of your sails, but the answer is yes.
Yes, you have.
No, yes, I haven't. You asked me if I had. Okay. No, we have not solicited any. I find that question faintly offensive, but no funds have been solicited in any way or kind.
Well, sir, the question would have been unnecessary had you
agreed
to put all your donations in public, in full, prior to the election. Thank you.
Yes. That's fine.
Bill Thompson is my name. I reside in City Road at South Bank. Moved there in 2009 and paid $21,000 stamp duty to help defray the cost of the state. We've paid about $1,000 a year in rates since we've been there. I've recently written to the council complaining about what I regard as the blight on the amenity of the CBD of rough sleepers or vagrants camping in the streets. And I've had discussions on the phone with a couple of council officers who, and in my words, advised me that except in some circumstances, these vagrants cannot be moved on from sleeping on the footpaths whenever and wherever they want. And if ratepayers are unhappy with the resultant effect on our enjoyment of the amenity of the CBD, then we can just suck it up. Because the human rights of the vagrants trump the human rights of the ratepayers. Is that a fair description of the circumstances at present with regard to rough sleepers on the footpaths of the CBD of Melbourne?
Bill, I certainly hope that no officer of the council used a phrase like that to you.
Well, I'm sorry if you're offended by that, but I'm paying the,
bills. But Bill, I'm on your side here. I'm trying to help. I hope no council officer used language like suck it up to you.
I said that was my interpretation
said. I'm sorry to hear that. I am advised that we have advised you we can have outreach workers to visit the locations you specified in your letter. I think we've advised you that if the streets need cleaning or if you want us to visit a certain location, we will do that. Can I offline, and I think the most effective way of dealing with this, if it's not a police issue, and that's a different thing, Bill, as you and I know, and that's a 000 issue, if it's an issue of the homeless who are there, I can give you the number of the outreach for the Salvation Army, and I can make you the promise. I can talk to them and make sure they get a team down there straight away to address that and deal with the people who are there.
The alternative is that we share with you guys that they camp in front of your place on a similar timetable for each night of the week. They spend a couple of nights in front of my place and then a couple of nights in front of your place. About that?
Well, Bill, surely the answer is not tit for tat. Surely the answer is if these are people who are on a criminal track, then the police are the correct response. If they are people with substance abuse or mental illness problems, we need a health response, and the Salvation Army is a better way to go, along with Melbourne City Mission, rather than kind of saying, you know, if I may say, gratuitous statements like that.
Thank you for your time.
Tony.
I'm not asking anyone to suck anything up.
Thank you, Tony.
But, Lord Mayor, question to you in relation to Boyd. We continuously see the, we've had the community consultation on that Boyd Park. We continuously see on Participate Melbourne that there's a date that's proposed for the release of that project, and then the date gets changed, and then it gets changed again, and, you know, and on it goes. My question is, why can't we receive a copy of that first round of consultation for what was decided with the park, etc.? I understand there's issues with the development, but that should be separate to what's happening with that open space.
Tony, I don't know the answer to that. I can't see any reason why you can't be given that. The drop-dead date, and it is drop-dead, is the end of this month. It's not very far away.
But that's for the development, not for
it
the
is.
Park.
No, but, well, they're tied because the developer has to do the park. Can I take advice on that? And I can't see any reason why you can't see the plans for the park, and we're happy to provide those that Mackie have provided to us, which we accepted. But the drop-dead date for them is the 30th of this month. And can I say to you, if they are not able to satisfy us about proceeding with that project, then we are back out to market again, which would be in some ways a bad result. In other ways, given the value of land, may be a good result for us. But we share with you the ambition to have one third of that entire site as great public open space. But can I take it on notice about providing with the plans? But I should think that's fine.
So if nothing happens, there's a possibility we could get that other third back for open space in the in South Bank?
Probably not. Don't push your luck. No, we actually need a commercial development on about one third, as you know, Boyd, and about one third, and then open space in the best way possible for about one third. Are there any further questions for us? In that case, could I call on Councillor Ong to assume the role of chair in relation to the planning portfolio?
Thank you a lot, Mayor. There are three reports on management for consideration under the planning portfolio tonight. The first agenda item is 6.1, the ministerial referral TPM 2014-22, which is 185 Roslyn Street, West Melbourne. I'd like to call Kate Youngkin, our acting planning coordinator, to make a brief presentation on this item.
Lord Mayor, Deputy Lord Mayor, Councillors, General Public. This is an application that has been referred to the City of Melbourne, formally referred, and the applicant is Urbis, the architect ARM Architects, and the owner is Thurvey Property Group. The site is located north of Dudley Street, on the corner, also on the corner of Adley Street and Roslyn Street. The site is very large, it's approximately 9,000 square metres. Here are some images of the site. It currently contains a warehouse building with an open lot car park. The proposal is for essentially five buildings built on top of a podium of about four stories. As we can see here, the proposal includes a through block link, pedestrian through block link, and open space here. The buildings will contain dwellings, these four buildings here, and there's also proposed to be service departments, which are about 87 service departments, and 442 apartments. These images show the proposal. So for Dudley Street, the development is 13 storeys. There is a 6 metre setback from Dudley Street, though, above four storeys. And to Roslyn Street, the development presents as nine storeys and then eight storeys, which is the service department on the corner of Adley Street. This slide demonstrates the ground floor. The ground floor is quite activated with Soho apartments along Dudley Street, and then we have the service departments and retail where the purple outline here is here. And there's also, which is a benefit to the West Melbourne community, a supermarket proposed internally. The supermarket is quite large. It's about 1,500 square metres. Here we have a typical floor plate of the podium, demonstrating the layout of the apartments. The tower layout. The northwest elevation, so Roslyn Street. Dudley Street. A section through showing, demonstrating the basement car parking and also this, the supermarket. And here is the open space. So the open space is above three levels of basement. The perspective from the corner of Dudley and Adderley Street. These are some shadow diagrams demonstrating that the open space will be overshadowed quite significantly at 10 p.m. At 12, it's not so much. And then throughout the day, not so bad. Any questions?
Thank you for that, Kate. You may take a seat. I now call on Robert DiCintio on behalf of the Trenary Group to present. To the committee, you have 3 minutes. The beeper will sound after two, and then you have 1 minute to wind up.
Thank you, councillors, for the opportunity to respond to that presentation. We've lodged a submission in response to the application. The design and development, the design team is a Tier 1 grade team headed up by Ashton Raggett McDougall, one of the country's premier architects, if not one of the world's very good architects, and highly awarded architectural firm, who have put the design together. The design basically came about by undertaking a series of workshops with Village Well to derive an appropriate placemaking strategy. We believe we've fulfilled that. We've undertaken a significant community consultation program and have performed many meetings prior to lodgement of the application and during. We have received not one objection. A submission of support, in fact, was received by the North West Melbourne Traders Association in support of our application. The bulk and the scale of the proposed development is very conservative, with a plot ratio of 7.9. I'll repeat that, a 7.9 plot ratio. It's hardly an aggressive or greedy application. The project design and master plan has been tested with the retail and business community. We have put this, we have put the application to various supermarket operators. We have received interest from all of them, and we've run with Aldi, who have agreed to commit to it. We've put the hotel to a number of operators, and we've reached agreement with Adina to run a 4.5-star hotel. So far, of all, we've had endorsement from all stakeholders bar one at the moment, being the planning officers of the Melbourne City Council. Of the 330 metres of frontage to all the streets, 90% is activated. It's a $300 million development, a development that's owned and run by Melburnians, for owner-occupiers of Melbourne. Over 400 apartments are proposed, as you heard. There's over 1,000 bedrooms in this development, over 400 living areas. Not one habitable room is reliant on borrowed light. Notwithstanding whatever your decision will be tonight, we have proposed an excellent scheme by a high-calibre team. And we expect, and we propose that it be approved, but regardless of what happens,
we will
agree to work with council going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Before you get now, I would like to ask a question. When you talked about all the architects and the placemaking, reading the report, you are proposing open space of roughly 567 square metres.
The open space is closer to 600 square metres.
Okay, 600 square metres.
And there's another 2,000 of open square metres of open space.
The open space that I'm talking about, the public open space, rather than your private open space under level 3. In terms of the, do you understand that the DDO has a certain recommendation? You are basically going at three times the DDO, but you argue that you're providing open space based on the total site. I would have thought that, or have you considered the thought that if you were going three times the DDO, that maybe you should give a larger public open space?
Thank you for the question. Sorry, have you finished? Thank you for the comment. The open space that we've proposed is above 5% of the land area, which complies with the amount of open space required.
If I may just follow up with a question, I understand what you're saying. It complies with the open area with the set DDO. What I'm asking the question is, you are three times the DDO. Have you considered being a bit more generous with public open space?
We're open to discussion with council, and as I said before, we're prepared to work with the planning department of both the council and the department going forward. But whether we go for three times, I'm not too sure. We'd have to look at a complete redesign.
As you can see, the current recommendation, are you suggesting that you would prefer to not for council to make a decision tonight, that you want to continue further discussions, or we make the decision tonight and you restart the process?
I'm not sure. Is that possible?
Well, I'm not saying that it's possible, but this is something that we've got a recommendation. But I think you need to consider that you might have to do something after what council's decided. Okay. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, we understand that. And
yes. Yeah. Lord Mayor.
Not of Robert. Can I ask a question of our officers? If this proposal provides the 5% of public open space and its plot ratio is 8 to 1, not the 24 to 1 that the interim controls provided, why does this not meet the density that we seek?
So the site isn't contained within DDO 10, which is the plot ratio requirements. The open space, we've got advice from our open space planners at council. The general rule is that we don't want any built form underneath our park, so that we can, one, we won't have legal issues in the future in terms of leaks and those sort of things, but it's also about establishing trees and having significant trees on the site. So in terms of the open space, it's what's being provided is just not supported.
If they're meant to provide 5, what percentage do you say they provide?
Well, it's 5 under the planning scheme at the moment, but it needs to be 5 that is actually usable and
No. Is it under the planning scheme 5%? Does it count in our own rules?
Yes, under the...
So they've met their requirements for open space, whether we like it or not. They've met the requirements for open space?
No, they haven't met the requirements in terms of the criteria of open space that we envisage for...
Do they meet it for the planning scheme?
No.
Okay. Secondly, why do we object to density if it is 8 to 1 versus the 24 to 1 that the Minister has had in place as an interim control for nearly a year?
It's the built form, so the site is in a 4-storey height control currently.
Yeah.
There's the West Melbourne Structure Plan Review that's currently taking place. It's very early days. It's at community consultation. So at the moment, they are three times the height.
Thank you, Kate. And thank you for the presentation too, by both. Look, I'll move the recommendation that's up on the screen and I'll speak to it for going through a number of issues that's been raised in the report. I call for Councillor seconder. Councillor Leppard. Thank you, Councillor Leppard. As described in the presentation, it's a 9,200 square metre site, which is an extremely large site. As the City of Melbourne is undergoing the West Melbourne Structure Plan review, which hasn't been done since early 2000 or 2001, and the densification of the city has required us to bring this forward and actually do this properly. One of the things in here is we know that densification is necessary as the population of the city grows, and it's logical that the movements we're seeing is going towards the west part of Melbourne, which has a mix of residential, commercial, industrial, and old warehouses and other sort of businesses. But the concept of densification is not something that the city is against. What we the report very clearly looks at some of the issues of urban design, some of the issues of how this interface with the other parts around it. The applicants put up this diagram to show the transition. It's consistent with what's happening around West Melbourne at Batman Street and other streets in that area that there's increased height and density. But one of the key challenges is the kind of built form that's going to be there. Do we have the visual bulk rather than the density? So it's a question of what the design is. And normally when applicants ask for greater height and density.
Councillor, I'm trying to be gentle, but this is not a time for discussion. No, no. It's a time for questions.
I'm going through this to support this, Lord Mayor, sorry. Yeah. So it's when I look at this thing, I think the key issues raised by officers is how it sets in urban context and the built form and the bulk. Now, height was never considered an issue. It just says it's three times the DDO that we're looking at. We've seen the diagrams. I think we all agree that height-wise is nothing like what we've seen. 420 Spencer Street, which is next door, is significantly taller at 130 metres roughly. The built form is the impact on the street, and I think that's one of the key issues. My personal other issue is, which I raised the question, is when you're building something that big with 400 over apartments and then you build a 600 square metre open space, a public open space, and say it complies. And my response is, yes, it complies. If you build a DDO at three or four levels, but now you are actually bigger. Plot ratio of 7.9 in this area is different from the 24 that's in the C262, which is more in the central city. So I looked at a lot of those issues, and I still think that there's work to be done by the applicant, there's work to be done by the architects, and to engage further, because as it stands now, I think the officers are correct in their evaluation. There are a number of things that still needs to be refined, because it's not about being greedy, it's about how it relates to the areas around it, whether the podium could be higher and the towers are narrow or taller. Height is not always the issue. And here the plot ratio is only 7.9. But how it relates to the streets is what's very important. So I'm supporting what the officers would recommend, and I actually recommend that the applicant spend a bit more time trying to get a better outcome for the area. There are more ways to build than to build these bulk items. Seconder.
Thank you, Chair. I do agree with your comments, and I also thank the applicant for coming in and engaging with the Council on this question. Of course, the Minister is the responsible authority, and the decision is yet to be made. Obviously, if there are more discussions between the applicant and the Minister, that's a matter for them, not a matter for us. But the way it's going, I think the City of Melbourne does need to put this position quite firmly. Just to clarify the plot ratio issue, though, the test here isn't a plot ratio test, it's a height test. plot ratio is more language we're using in the central city at the moment, but we have to understand, I think, that the transition to a more stable and a established community in parts of West Melbourne from the city requires sensitivity. That's why we have a DDO in place that recommends a 4-storey height limit. If you take out setback considerations and the 5% open space considerations, you could translate that to being a plot ratio benchmark of roughly 3.5 to 1 or 4 to 1, somewhere in that. So given that the plot ratio is more than double what the plot ratio could be if you translate the height control into a plot ratio, it doesn't even meet that test. So I think it was a good try, but given that the height is 3 times more than what the DDO asks for, and if you translate that to a plot ratio test, it's still more than double. You do have to say that this site is an overdevelopment in the form that it's currently in. Where the discussions go from here, that's a matter for the applicant and the minister, but I think the City of Melbourne does need to say that this does not fit inside the West Melbourne community, and that's quite clear.
Thank you, Councillor Leppard. Any further speakers to the motion? Any speakers? Yes, Councillor Mayne.
This is a tricky one. It's not often you get an application with no objections, 90% street frontages, no borrowed light, being unanimously rejected, which may or may not happen. So I'm tempted to make it not unanimous. I think that it is good that Robert has turned up. I mean, sometimes with ministerials, people take the view, well, it's the minister deciding, we won't even engage with the council. So I think it is important that we give people a hearing. Ultimately, we will be sending our report to the department, and the department will be advising the minister, and the minister will be making the decision, and the delegate's report will be published on the website. So we will get to see transparently what the professional advice is from Spring Street as well as from Town Hall. And I'd simply encourage the applicant to make some concessions. So when you get the second go up with the minister, you do move on sort of the officer's comments about the sort of the monolithic proposal. You do acknowledge the existing 4 storeys. I think we should acknowledge that West Melbourne is potentially changing. We are reviewing this part of town. And you have got a neighbour at 130 metres when you're at 25. Although that was a particularly poor decision, that 130 metres in a different era. So this is quite a complex situation where I don't think it's straightforward. So I think for that reason, I will probably vote against the officer's recommendation, knowing that and supporting the fact that the council will officially be rejecting it. But it may not be unanimous. And as you go into negotiations with the state, I'd encourage you to move significantly on the points raised by the officers.
Thank you, Councillor Mayne. I gather that was a speaker against the motion. I wasn't sure. It started. Any speakers who actually say they are speaking against the motion?
Chair, sorry, could I just ask a question? I'm just confused. Because this is a ministerial referral. How do we know there are no objections? Sorry, maybe if not you, Chair.
Yes, maybe the officers might know from the DelWhip, or started off as DTPLI in the application.
Yes, so the application was advertised, and was advertised to council. Council's not aware of if there any objections have been received up at the state government, or so. Yeah, we can't confirm that there are no objections to the application.
Yeah, this is okay. We will take that on the word of the applicant.
No,
that's fine.
The planning department hasn't received any objections.
Thank you. Okay. Further speakers? Councillor Wood?
I'll speak for the officer recommendation here. I must admit, I take Councillor Mayne's point. I think if you had been looking at that without sort of any respect to the existing height limit, then you'd probably say that the density here is something that we want to look at for a transition from the capital city zone to West Melbourne. I do take on board, though, the comments from officers about the visual bulk. I think more work can be done on that. For me, the biggest sticking point is the public open space, where if it's not usable in terms of deep planting, if there's issues where potentially we're going to see leaks into car parks and the rest of it, then ultimately it's not open space as we would like to see it. So for me, I think the applicant needs to work harder on the usable public open space. Also, when you look at the overshadowing, the ability to actually plant out that public open space and indeed deliver a benefit to the development as well is something that I think you should work on. But I do take some of Councillor Main's well-made points on this one, as we do see West Melbourne start to change.
Thank you, Councillor Wood. Any further speakers? No, I'll close this debate by just a couple of points to acknowledge the actual benefits that's part of the proposal, the supermarkets, the shops activate, because when we were doing the West Melbourne Structure Plan review, we did a couple of consultation workshops with over 200 people from the area who said that they needed some more provision of retail and shopping, because if you go down to West Melbourne currently and you try to find a shop to buy something, you actually have to walk several blocks because there's hardly anything. Councillor Main mentioned before, and I raised it before, 420 Spencer Street was a decision made many years ago, and I have to admit that councillors then were confused in the terms of what was the way, because the officers were objecting to it, and it was proposed that there would be some other legal way to object to that. In the end, it didn't turn out that way, and we actually accidentally let it through. So we're not going there again. What's important now is that what we have here is an opportunity to really have a great development that will add to the West Melbourne area. Another, we all know that Dudley Street is sort of the boundary between the renewal part to the south and a lot of the established part to the north from Roden and Dryburg and all that. So we need to make sure they manage that built form really well in that transition zone. Because while we haven't finished the work on the West Melbourne Structure Plan, I guess the markets decided that now we will most likely go a bit more density than it currently is. That may or may not be so. But it is quite a large area in the study. If you're not sure how big the area is, you can always go to this council website. What we want to do is to make sure that the West Melbourne area develops into the future, into the next 15 years, into something that we'll be proud of, rather than letting it run out of control. There are parts of the city we've lost control, and this is one part of the city we hope we won't lose control. So I encourage, as said by some of my fellow councillors, encourage the developer to do some more work, even though after today, is to engage with the state government department, DELWIP, and get some inputs from the city planners. Thank you. On that note, I'll put it to the vote. All those in favour of the recommendation, raise your hands. Lord Mayor, Deputy Lord Mayor, Councillor Leppard, Councillor Oak, Councillor Wood, Councillor Ong, Councillor Peter Mortimer, Councillor Watts, Councillor Foster, and Councillor Louis. All those against? Councillor Main. Just to make sure it's not unanimous. I declare it carried. Next agenda item 6.2, Ministerial Referral TPM 2016-3, which is 24-46 Abacut Street. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? No. On that note, I would call Hugh Smythe on behalf of FJB Planning to address the committee. Hugh, you have 3 minutes.
Good evening, councillors. My name is Hugh Smythe. I'm the director of SJB Planning. SJB Planning has been assisting RMIT University with its proposed redevelopment of 24 A Beckett Street. We're here tonight to support the officer recommendation, which is before you for consideration tonight. The officer report spells out in some detail how this proposal responds to the controls and policies of the Melbourne Planning Scheme, It's a proposal that's fully compliant with DDO 10, introduced via Planning Scheme Amendment 262. It's designed by Denton Corker Marshall, an award-winning architectural practice, and reflects RMIT's ongoing commitment to its development proposals in the Melbourne CBD and achieving high standards of design and quality public realm outcomes. It's also reflective of the City of Melbourne's ongoing and continued commitment to working with the City of Melbourne in its endeavours across the municipality, but specifically within the Melbourne Central City. We therefore support the officer recommendation and commend it to you for consideration, and respectfully request that you resolve to advise the Minister of Council's support for the grant of a permit subject to the conditions contained in the officer report. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh. I'd like to ask you a question. The proposal proposes a number of bicycle parking, no car parks, as such, no motorcycle parking either. You know that recently the council made a recommendation to write to the minister to look at the planning scheme amendment to review the future that we have new buildings include off-street motorcycle parking. As we know, the clutter in the streets are now getting a little bit out of control. Would the applicant, which is RMIT, consider the provision of motorcycle parking, even though under the planning scheme that if you don't have any cars, you actually don't need motorcycles because it's 40-1. We're seeing that there's more motorcycle use, and as a result, if you're not having any car parking, would RMIT consider, the before you finalise everything, to put in some motorcycle parking, which would only mean about 5 or 6 spaces in the whole development? What are your thoughts?
I don't have any specific instructions on that particular matter, Councillor Wong, but I see no reason in a practical sense why that couldn't be explored. One of the challenges will be providing safe and convenient access to those motorcycle spaces, because this development doesn't contain any on-site car parking. The only access into the basement levels has been designed for waste collection vehicles and delivery vehicles. So the idea of motorcyclists having to interface with larger, heavy vehicles would be a design challenge. It's been resolved with the bicycle parking by providing a dedicated bicycle ramp into the first basement level. Mm-hmm. I don't want to put my traffic engineer hat on because I'm not a traffic engineer, so I won't. But I would anticipate there's some challenges associated with having motorcycles interfacing with bicycles, which sounds strange given they've both got two wheels, but one's got a motor and one doesn't. The loading could well be resolved, but given this is a ministerial application because of the GFA, I'd be more than happy to, following this meeting, go back to RMIT and explore that with the project architects. And for instance, if I can make a suggestion, there's no reason why the officer recommendation could not be amended to include a condition to require some additional motorcycle parking spaces, and we could explore that with RMIT and the department.
Very good. Very good. That's what I'd like to hear there, because it's a technical challenge, but it is not impossible.
Anything's possible.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you then, Hugh. You may take your seat, and I would like to move a slightly amended recommendation. It's basically the first part all the way, and then adds in that encourages the owner of the land to provide motorcycle spaces within the approved basements, and the motorcycle spaces might not result in the reduction of bicycle parking spaces and associated facilities like the showers and change rooms. I put that as a challenge to the applicant because I think it's consistent with the position we've taken not so long ago in council. I call on the councillor to second that motion. Yes, sorry. It's an encouragement. Thank you, Councillor Leppard. Look, in terms of the proposal, I think it's great that RMIT is investing in the city and our more educational facilities as well as some administration spaces for its organisation. City of Melbourne's been partnering RMIT on a number of developments and projects throughout the city in the arts and design areas and even in the fashion areas. So it is a good corporate citizen that we work with. We all know that the city is getting more congested, and the recent report that the Future Melbourne Committee tabled and approved that looked at the future new developments should have off-street motorcycle and bicycle parking. So I thought this was an opportunity that in the city, and it's a commercial building sort of, it's not a residential building per se, so that this was an opportunity to encourage, rather than put it as a condition, but to encourage the applicant, in this case RMIT, to consider this while the process of getting the ministerial action could take a while. But the intent is very clear in the City of Melbourne what we would like to do moving forward. So I'm glad to see Hugh says there might be some technical challenges in terms of the design, but they will take this on board. Councillor Leppert.
Thank you, Chair. Interesting precedent if we're going to start adding to resolutions all the things we'd like to see above and beyond the statutory requirements. So I commend your optimism and ambition, but I note, of course, that there's no requirement for the provision of motorcycle parks. I believe also that motorcycle parks are pegged to the number of car parks. And given that the requirement for the number of car parks here is that zero is fine, therefore, even under the newly adopted, not adopted review, but the noted review that we've sent to the state for consideration, it might not result in a requirement for motorcycle parks on a site like this either. However, there are lots of students, lots of users of this space who will take their motorbike to be here, and so you know it's a good thing to look at, and so let's see what comes of it. That aside, the application is a very strong one. It complies absolutely with the new DDO 10 controls and the mandatory setbacks, and is within the plot ratio that's been stipulated in that control. We haven't seen too many of those come through yet. This is certainly the largest that meets all of those tests and that we're waving through quite quickly. So I'm sure the Minister will approve this one quite quickly as well, and excited to see this development go underway. The three blocks immediately to the north of Melbourne Central are getting incredibly dense, and it's going to be an ongoing challenge for the city going forward. We will, of course, have a new train station there in a year or 10, but it does comply with every test in the scheme, so well done.
Thank you, Councillor Leppert. A bit pessimistic about the metro. Any speakers against the motion? For the speakers to the motion? If not, I won't add further comments to this, and I'll put it to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare it carried unanimously. Next, agenda item 6.3, which is the options for Hoddle Grid Heritage Review. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? If not, I call on Tristan Davis, President of Melbourne Heritage Action, to address the committee. You have Tristan? You have 3 minutes.
Thanks. Can I just ask quickly, do I need to change the slides or is that done? Okay, great. Well, thank you, Lord Mayor and Councillors, for letting us speak here. Melbourne Heritage Action wishes to applaud the City of Melbourne on finally taking steps towards the first comprehensive review of the city's heritage in many decades, in which, despite some positive gap studies like C186, many unlisted buildings have fallen through the cracks and been needlessly demolished. For a budget of less than a third of that of the yearly fireworks budget, council can approve a review that will finally give many significant buildings and precincts, lane lays and public artworks a fair and due process in the planning scheme and create far more certainty and less divisiveness between owners, developers and the community with the full scope of heritage worth saving laid bare. And you can see many examples of buildings that have been lost through the years. That's just a small sample. We strongly urge you to push ahead with this option A, lest more heritage is lost in the coming years. Option A, which is a comprehensive review of the entire CBD at once, will also be the only option that will be secure in its comprehensiveness and truly reflective of what needs to be listed and what may not be as significant in comparison in the eyes of both the community and future planning panels. That's just a brief study of a few buildings in the CBD that could be protected by this amendment. For a knowledge and creative city like Melbourne, heritage and adaptable reuse are essential to our livability, vibrancy and branding. Sorry, there's a few quotes there you could have read, but maybe later, in regards to that sort of thing. In advocating for this study, MHA are not advocating for less development, just better development, as a great many of the potentially listed places will still be developable, only with heritage and culture placed into consideration and possibly retained in the process. Like in many of the best combinations of old and new in the city, such as Urban Workshop, the Rialto development, notwithstanding the recent loss of that Robs Annex, and, of course, the TNG building just down Collins Street from Town Hall. Melbourne can once again become a leading Australian city in heritage preservation and celebration, and we hope that you all put your votes to this essential motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Tristan. Any questions for the speaker? No? You may take a seat. I would now call a councillor to move a motion. Is there one more speaker? Oh, sorry, I missed that. Felicity Watson from the National Trust. Sorry, Felicity. My eyes are giving up on me. You have 3 minutes too, Felicity.
Hello, and thank you for the opportunity to address councillors and Lord Mayor. I'd like to begin by also acknowledging the work of council officers to put together this comprehensive options paper and for council's willingness to consider options for a future comprehensive heritage review. This is indicative of a strong commitment to heritage that has been demonstrated through recent work such as the Burke Hill Amendment, the Arden Macaulay Heritage Review and the City North Heritage Review, all of which the National Trust have been party to. I don't really want to repeat the excellent points that were raised by our colleagues at Melbourne Heritage Action, but we believe that committing to a comprehensive study, such as the HODL Grid Heritage Review, requires vision and courage, and this is what we're asking of councillors. Indeed, it was vision and courage which resulted in the adoption of the first heritage study for Melbourne by Graham Butler in 1985. 30 years on, much has changed. Heritage buildings have been demolished, some of which were highlighted by Tristan. This means that existing graded buildings are potentially rarer and more significant, and this needs to be reviewed. We have come to understand that heritage significance extends beyond the facades of buildings to the fine grain of our bluestone laneways and the social significance of our theatres and restaurants. What we know is that it's easier to protect heritage places and provide certainty to property investors and developers through proactive protection, rather than responding in an ad hoc way when a place is threatened by a planning application. We must move towards proactive protection rather than reactive protection. When the recognised significance of a heritage place is out of step with community expectations, long and expensive battles are waged. The Palace Theatre comes to mind. The National Trust therefore calls upon Council to be courageous and to proceed with the HODL Grid Heritage Review, voting for option one to undertake the entire HODL Grid study in one go. While we acknowledge that option one is a significant investment in the short term, the Trust believes that it is vital that this work be incorporated into the budget for the next financial year to ensure that it's completed in a timely manner. Staging the study over 4 years would likely result in the loss of further heritage places during the course of work, and there is a danger that a staged study could be abandoned midstream. Undertaking the study according to option one would also provide greater certainty to property owners, developers, and potential investors. We ask that you vote in favour of this once-in-a-generation review to ensure that heritage is protected for generations to come. History will thank you for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Felicity. Any questions for the speaker? No. I now call on the councillor to move a motion.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to move an alternative motion if we scroll down. I distributed it. I sent it through this afternoon.
While we're waiting, I'd like to ask you a question of the officers. CEO?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Saved it.
Yeah, that's the one.
Thank you, Chair. I'll move it in the terms as it appears on the screen.
I'm happy to second it. Second it.
Thank you very much, Chair. This report that's come before us, and I'm very grateful to officers for putting all of this work together. I understand that it took a bit longer than it first was anticipated, but the product that's come back to us is wonderful, and obviously a lot of work's gone into it. But the report is a result of the motion I commissioned in November 2015 to provide us with options, and I can only say thank you to officers for doing that work. The need for a review is very, very clear. The current most up-to-date comprehensive heritage review of built form in the Hoddle grid is the Butler Review of 1984-85, adopted then. So it's 31 years since we've adopted or updated that heritage study. 93, of course, I think it was the Raworth update, was never adopted by council. Stop it, Councillor Wood. And since then, for whatever reason, and there's been a series of political and other reasons why Council has not updated the comprehensive study. Of course, we've done C186 in 2011. We can only commend the previous Council for completing that. That protected the low-hanging fruit, if you like. It was a desktop study, and thank goodness that's happened. And, of course, the good news this week is that the Ministers acted on the other part of the motion that I moved in November and gazetted 9 more buildings from C186 Part 2 just yesterday. I think we might have done it on Friday, and put interim heritage protection over 9 more buildings. Those were the low-hanging fruit. That was the low-hanging fruit, I beg your pardon. What we're still missing is the comprehensive heritage study, which, if we want to bring government's policies up to date and not leave them 31 years out of date, we need to do. So I think the case has been well made that we do need to do this. How that may or may not be translated into heritage overlays in the future is, of course, a matter for the future, but you can't do any of that work without starting with a heritage study. I think the Melbourne Heritage Action submission made a few points about some of the buildings that are currently graded but don't fall in a heritage overlay and are in desperate need of an update to the heritage study, and there's quite a few of my favourite buildings in the CBD on that list as well. Rutherglen House, I think we should hopefully ultimately put a heritage overlay on that, if not over Peter Jansen himself. I don't know if that works in the planning scheme, but we should give it a go. The AB1 and Tonic building, which I note the owners know the value of heritage, and so they've completely refurbished that building and made it look absolutely beautiful despite a complete absence of a heritage overlay. These owners know the value of up-to-date heritage values, and they've really built into that property a wonderful facade and upgraded that property as well, but that's a prime candidate. Patterson's on Burke Street and Epstein House as well, a few of my favourites, but that's just me. Now, I want to do this review in 1 year. I agree with Felicity and National Trust submission just then that I want to do it in 1 year. However, the advice that's come back to us in bits and pieces, it's in the report, but it's also come back to us today in other forms, is very strong. The market capacity to do this work is limited. There's a limited number of heritage consultants in Melbourne that can do this work, and we need to respect that. We have seven projects that are on our list for 2016-17. They've been released in the draft list of annual plan actions. There are seven separate related heritage studies or planning scheme amendment processes, and these are both expensive and very resource-intensive and staff-time-intensive projects to undertake. I'm very, very glad we're doing it, but for example, we need to complete the Guildford Lane precinct review that's nearly done and follow that through to some statutory changes rather than stop that while we do the whole grid all in one go. I think that's important. But I don't like option two either, and I think the report talks itself out of option two because of the cons that are listed there. Once you know what the fourth quadrant is, and by the time you get to the fourth quadrant, the signal you've sent to the market is so strong that you don't necessarily know what's going to be left. So I'm going for a hybrid here. And so the motion is different to what's been recommended to us, and it doesn't adopt any of the three options. First of all, it changes the study area. I think there was a bit of an oversight. The City North study didn't go down to Latrobe Street. It went down to Beckett Street, so we've got to add those three blocks. We do proceed with the year one funding arrangement that has been recommended to us in option two, but noting that there's so many heritage projects in 2016-17, we don't add to that in our first year, but we aspire to do this as fast as possible after that. We will have learnt a lot in that first year, we'll have built the capacity of our work area in that first year, and hopefully we'll be well placed come budget time in a year's time to do the rest of that project all in one go. And if the advice to us is, for whatever reason, you know, that we need to take a slightly different tack, then of course we'll take that advice as well. But the aspiration is quite clear here that we do it as fast as possible, and certainly faster than option two has set out for us. And thirdly, I do take issue with the suggestion that we divide the grid into quadrants. The quadrants intersect prime candidates for precincts, and so we shouldn't necessarily determine now what the boundaries of the split of that review should be. We also have to acknowledge that C186 Part 2 only has interim protection for 1 year. We might want to start with some of those interwar and post-war buildings. And so rather than decide here and now where we start, I think we just refer that decision back to management to consider these various issues. We authorise the funding envelope to start this project and give it a really good go, and then set the message here that we want to get the rest of the project done as fast as possible. So that sets out the reasons for the change in tack compared to what's in the report, and I commend the alternative.
Thank you, Councillor Lepet. As the seconder, I'd like to commend Councillor Lepet for his enthusiasm and his commitment to this process. He's been pushing it, so as the Chair of Planning, I'm happy to let him push it. But what's very important that what he says is true, and also I acknowledge the two presentations and the correspondence received. We know that when the City of Melbourne, about 25 years ago, started to develop its postcode 3000, and that's creating a city where people come and live in it. And the first step of that is to reuse some existing old buildings, heritage buildings, like the Mallorca building and the Hero building. But it also then realized that, we didn't probably realize that then, when the activity level increases, we did lose a number of buildings in the city. Because, as you say, some of these protection in the early studies did not go down to the detail. The C186 process was quite extensive. If many of you who are here tonight will remember that that report with 648 pages or so, where you read through the Graham Butler report in detail, and you realize that the amount of work involved to get to that sort of detail to protect certain buildings, that 100 buildings, was enormous. Now we're looking at this process, a necessary process, and when I read through the report and I said, can we do this in the first year? And I think Councillor Lepet's answered that in this discussions. If we try to do everything in the first year without the skills and the resource and the knowledge out there in industry and within the City of Melbourne, we might end up doing a not so detailed and high quality job, which results in not achieving the kind of protection we hope to achieve. And I think what Councillor Leppard's done in this hybrid solution is that let's get going, but don't try to kill everyone in the first year. I think that's important with all the other projects. Finish off those other projects, put more resources in the second year, and try to finish this in 2 years. And if the council is clear in what its objectives are in the public space, it will also send a clear message to industry that we're doing this, so don't try to outsmart us and try to demolish things quickly. I think that's very important. There is one issue when I was reading through that, it's in the back of my mind. And what Tristan said, heritage protection does not exclude redevelopment. In the case of looking at heritage buildings, and I've come across the numbers, and one of the key challenges is redevelopment that has to comply with DDA requirements. And in heritage buildings, that's not the easiest thing to do. So I can understand why people get worried about some of those things, because as chair of disability, DDA is a very important thing. So for a city which clearly has a policy that we are a city for all people. So there's a balance to be achieved, and we'll have to see how the progress of this study comes out, because I think it's important that if there's redevelopment heritage properties, do it well and make sure everyone's catered for. Further speakers to the motion. Councillor Watts.
Well, it's with some frustration that I speak now in support of Councillor Leppard's compromise motion. It's a good one. He's worked very hard on this. Nobody could be more enthusiastic about accelerating the heritage protection in this city, and I'm very pleased that someone, Councillor, is so keen to do this too. There's a point that I really want to make, though, is that let's all understand what we're dealing with here. We're talking about an investment in our city. The $1 million is not a lot of money. We're talking about an investment, not a cost. There's plenty of research which says that the investment in heritage protection is very, very beneficial in an economic sense to any given city. Just this week, I note a program on the television which cited Melbourne as one of the world's best places to come to see 19th century architecture, and we have much more modern architecture as well, more recent. So this is a very important step forward. It isn't as fast as I like, but I'm persuaded that we do need to develop the capacity. The officers have made it clear. In fact, the original motion is somewhat misleading from my reading of it, in that it talks about amortising the cost over a couple of years or 4 years, which thankfully is not going to happen. Not only, as Councillor Leppard's motion states, do we aspire for this to happen in 2 years, but we require, I personally would say, I would prefer to use the language require the complete study. Nevertheless, it's a very good motion, and I'm very grateful that we are able to demonstrate that we take heritage seriously in this city.
Thank you, Councillor Watts. Any speakers against this motion? Further speakers? Councillor Leppard, like to close? On that note, I'll put this to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare it carried unanimously. I call now the Lord Mayor, Robert Doyle, to assume the role of chair in the remainder of the meeting.
Thank you, Councillor. This concludes the reports from management to be considered in open session. There are 6 items of general business. The first is a notice of motion from Councillor Watts. Could I call on Tony Penner on behalf of South Bank residents to address the committee? Of course, Michael. Not at all.
I'm speaking on behalf of the Melbourne South Yarra Residents Group, and the first thing I'd like to do is congratulate Councillor Watts for doing something about this important issue, which is so badly dealt with under state legislation at the present time. Transparency is a critical issue if we're going to deal with questions of undue influence and corruption, and it's a pity, in my view and our view, that the Lord Mayor didn't instigate these moves, which are so important to the proper running of this council. The motion we support wholeheartedly, the first leg of that motion, The second part of that motion, which deals with disclosure as the year progresses, we also regard as extremely important, because if there's to be transparency, which is the critical issue, then to know what support councillors are receiving during the year as well as at the end of the year before the election is a very important matter, and it enables everybody to understand what is occurring, where the support's coming from, and what influence that may or may not have. So the both legs of that motion we think are critical, and we think it's high time that councillors took it upon themselves to improve what is clearly bad law in the state of Victoria, where there is absolutely no effective control of donations. And if we're to have faith in and trust in our councillors and our politicians and everybody else, we need to have full disclosure at all times so we can understand what is occurring. So congratulations, Councillor Watt. I hope your councillors understand the importance of this and support that motion.
Thank you, Michael. Could I call on Tony Penner, please?
Tony Penner, South Bank Residents Association. We too would like to commend Councillor Watts for her motion. Councillor Watts clearly understands the effect that this has on the community. Ideally, we would like to take it one step further and ban donations, but we understand that that's not what is being proposed here, and not that Councillor Watts or this council potentially could have even done that. It needs to be enshrined in law. However, this council could lead the way by talking to the powers to be and encouraging them to put it into law. This is very close to South Bank. So many times we have been robbed of the ability to have a say in this council about developments that affect South Bank, because this council has lost its quorum because of conflicted councillors owing to developer donations. Councillors are elected to represent the people. We hear time and time again, as elections approach, prospective councillors telling us that they represent the people. How can they represent the people when they've conflicted themselves on an important community topic? At the end of the day, South Bank residents are not concerned. At the end of the day, we don't care what the law says. It's just not right. Period. Full stop. And this council has an opportunity to try and correct some of that. We trust that the councillors will also concur with Councillor Watts's motion, particularly considering the elections are fast upon us. We, as residents who are voting for the prospective new councillors, need to know where we stand. We need to know who we're voting for. If this motion is not passed, what message does that send to the municipality?
Tony, if Clive Palmer was to run for council with a million dollar donation from that well-known developer, Donald Trump, this motion wouldn't pick it up, because it only applies to councillors. So do you think that we should cover the field and encourage all candidates who are backed by whoever?
Absolutely, yes. Not just councillors. But
this motion only covers councillors. Do you think should it cover candidates?
It should cover everybody, absolutely. Yeah, okay, yes, absolutely.
Thanks. Agreed. Thank you, Tony. Could I call on Councillor Watts to move the motion standing in her name?
So moved.
Is there a seconder for this motion? Councillor Foster, thank you. Councillor Watts.
Yes, thank you for the community for speaking
so enthusiastically about what I consider to be a no-brainer. We are in a position at Council where the public at large and the media, I fear, as well, is not confident that we're doing the right thing. The law doesn't require that we do the right thing, but we can take action ourselves, which is why I brought this motion before Council. I realise now that there are certain difficulties with this, as has just been discussed. My motion calls for a retrospective approach to this. My motion calls for declarations around offers and promises and all kinds of support in kind and cash. The intent is that we really need to cover all of the bases. We really need to restore confidence in our community that this council is able to govern without being repeatedly subject to conflict of interest issues. Now, I'm not confident that I have the numbers on council, but I am confident that this is a council committed to transparency. So I'm hopeful that, imperfect though it might be, this motion will be received well, or if amendments need to occur or subsequent motions put, that it's in some way indicates that this council is in favour of reform around local government democracy. We are the capital city council. We are governed under a different act, but we have an obligation, I believe, to the sector to step up, and if the law won't allow us to or doesn't require that we do the right thing, we do it ourselves. I'm concerned that if we don't go with the retrospective elements of my motion, that donations or promises or whatever made well in advance when candidates declare very early in order to make their availability known, that we don't know what impact these amounts of donation or these promises are having on decisions leading up to the election. So that is why I've included this element to my motion. I commend the motion. It is not perfect, but it is encouraging us in the right direction.
I won't speak at this stage, Lord Mayor, but I'll reserve my right to speak at a later stage in the debate.
Speaker to the debate. Councillor Mayne.
So I'd like to speak against the motion and foreshadow an alternative motion. As Councillor Watts has alluded to, there are some issues, I think, in the motion that she has lodged with us tonight. The first one, I think, is I agree that retrospectivity is difficult to go back to 2013. I think a motion that starts tonight is a better option, and my alternative will propose doing that. I think offers are just impractical. I mean, what is an offer? Is it in writing? Is it a legal contract? Is it just a casual conversation over a cup of coffee? Is it a late night conversation in the pub? So if we're going to do this, it's a complicated area and we need to do it right without any holes in it. And so it needs to be actual donations or actual received in-kind support, such as someone paying for your printing. So my alternative will cover that. Last time, The Age newspaper effectively ran this process and most tickets complied. And I think it's not a good look for a commercial media organisation to be running a governance program for the council. So I think there is an argument for council to step in. But another potential issue with Councillor Watts's proposal is that there has been some advice that we could be in breach of the state legislation on the caretaker provisions if we are publishing on our website during the caretaker period information about candidates. So there may be an issue of requiring an independent party, maybe the MAV, or to seek ministerial approval to be publishing material on our website supplied by candidates. The obvious one we've missed earlier is the fact that it needs to cover everyone, not just councillors. So my alternative will propose that we cover all candidates. It will stress that it's a voluntary code. I mean, the law is the law. You've got to declare your donations 40 days after the election. Another issue with Councillor Watts's motion is that it finishes up on October 22, which is election day. many donations will come in afterwards. You might have a good day at the Melbourne Cup, you might just not have realised your final amount you're contributing until November, and so you need to have a later close date, and I'm proposing a final publication date of November 15. So the principle is absolutely right. The law is an ass. It's even a bigger ass at state and federal level. I mean, donations received to the coming federal campaign on July 1, completely unlimited, not disclosed until February 1, 2018. So, and then they have no conflicts of interest regime. They just can vote on whatever they like, any donation, you name it. So it's anything goes in Canberra, which is a disgrace. Victoria largely has the same rules, which is also a disgrace. The local government rules are much better. So every 6 months, we have to disclose any gifts over $500. So Mr. Butcher's comments earlier about the poor disclosure regime is actually it's always disclosed 40 days after the last campaign, and any gifts over $500 are disclosed every 6 months. So we are already comprehensively disclosing campaign donations and gifts. What my alternative motion will do is have a timely and comprehensive program of voluntary disclosure, potentially hosted on an independent third-party website to be legislatively compliant, that will encourage everyone to comply and set best practice in disclosure. So my alternative, if it could be put up on the screen potentially just so that people can consider it before deciding whether to vote down Councillor Watts's motion.
Mayor, sorry, it's a point of order. Is Councillor Mayne debating Councillor Watts's motion or his own motion at the moment?
I did foreshadow it. So I'll speak to it substantially if we get to it. But I think I've covered some of the key points of some of the problems with Councillor Watts's motion, and I was a little bit disappointed that Councillor Watts's motion was provided to the media before it was provided to her colleagues, and including me as Chair of Finance and Governance. So. Not untrue. It's not untrue. I don't know who supplies your motions then, but I think that when we want to do this, we need to have a considered discussion, respectful discussion internally, and not play politics with it. When we put it up, we need to put it up in a credible and legal manner that doesn't have any holes in it. And so I do think there are substantial problems with Councillor Watts's motion, and therefore I foreshadow, I think we should vote against that, and I foreshadow the alternative which is displayed on the screen.
Is there a further speaker for the motion? Is there a speaker against the motion? That's your motion, Councillor, yes. Is there a further speaker to the motion?
I'll speak to the motion in that. Yeah, again, I'm not playing politics, but I can see the merit for the foreshadowed motion. So I'm speaking against the one that we're speaking to, not because I don't support the intent and the intention of Councillor Watts to bring greater transparency around councillor donations. I wholeheartedly support that, and obviously did at the last election, and I obviously support all councillors declaring in their quarterly... returns that any donations that they've received since being elected, and that's all obviously we do that accordingly to the law. So I will vote against this, knowing that there is another one coming that picks up some of the concerns around all candidates, not just elected councillors at the moment, and also the bit I was unsure about was around the offers of donations, it might seem facetious, but I was genuinely not sure how to deal with when my mother or my neighbour offers in the street, oh, let me know about your campaign, I'll support you. Does that mean I needed to then declare it in this way? And I'm not being facetious, I genuinely was not sure about that part. But other than that, I wholeheartedly support your intent and your campaign to get greater transparency of councillor donations, and I will be voting against it, but only because we have another one coming that picks up some of my concerns.
Thank you. Is there a further speaker to the motion? Councillor Wood.
Look, similar to Councillor Oakes' sentiment, I support the intent of Councillor Watt's motion. I think the intent is excellent. I think any of us here would be more than happy to comply with the intent, but given the issues identified by Councillor Mayne, I will be voting against this one and support Councillor Mayne's motion to pick up those issues. I think for me the one about the office also sort of was a one I wasn't too sure about how that would work, and I think with something like this, you know, to work it through in a collegiate manner, which I think we have done, is a good move, because the law is there. I agree with Councillor Watts that it doesn't go far enough. I think this is going to be a good move if we get some form of process in that's over and above the law. But when we make these sort of moves, we want to make sure that we're covering every base. There is no holes. There's nothing that sort of can, I guess, you know, have holes poked in it when a move like this is made. And hopefully this is something that then can be picked up by other councillors in City of Melbourne's leadership role.
Councillor Foster.
Yeah, thank you. I think Councillor Watts deserves our admiration tonight for taking us an enormous step forward by putting this this on the agenda fairly and squarely, and not just tonight, but over a number of years she's been actively campaigning around these issues, and we see tonight a motion representing that. I think it is actually a full and complete motion. I don't agree with all the comments that have been made against it, of course. I know that there have been some valid comments made about some amendments that could have been made to this in a collegiate way with Councillor Watts. It's a little disappointing that we see an amended motion instead, but nonetheless, at least that is there. That does pick up some of those criticisms of Councillor Watts's motion. Nonetheless, it is certainly very, very much on the right track. And again, I think the Councillor deserves our thanks and respect for having taken us such a step forward.
Any further contributions? Does the mover wish to... Councillor Pinder-Mortimer.
I'd just like to commend Councillor Mayne for the refinements to this motion. Thank you to Councillor Watts for bringing it up. And thank you to Councillor Mayne for a good deal of time spent refining it and enabling us to consider an alternate.
Thank you. Mover wish to conclude debate?
I am pleased to have the evidence that my colleagues are interested in this topic. It's regrettable, given that I undertook this in a spirit of collegiality and did circulate the motion in the due in the proper manner, that comments should be made against me now. It's certainly disappointing. I would say that in relation to the offers, there's already one there that was regrettably in the... Well, not regrettably, it was, would not have come to light if it had not been for the media. One of my colleagues on council has been offering hundreds of thousands of dollars for a certain position on council. It's all... I'm not going to go there except to say that that's the kind of offer I had in mind. I believe that... The motion that I've put before us has good qualities. As my colleague, Councillor Foster, had said, it was open to amendment, but the motion that will follow this, should this fail, which clearly it will have covered some of the perceived deficits. So again, I'm pleased that we're advancing the matter in this way anyway.
Thank you. In that case, can I put the motion? All those voting in favour of voting in favour of the original motion of Councillor Watts. All those in favour? Councillor Foster, Councillor Watts. Those against? Councillor Pinder-Mortimer, Councillor Louis, Councillor Mayne, Councillor Wood, Councillor Oak, Deputy Lord Mayor, myself and Councillor Leppett. The motion is lost. There is a foreshadowed motion, and I'd ask Councillor Mayne to formally propose that motion now.
I'd like to formally move the motion on the screen, Lord Mayor.
I'm very happy to second it, Councillor May.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we've certainly covered some of it, but just some of the detail up there is 1.1.1 talks about a report coming to the November 29 Council meeting, at which point the register comes down. And that would be a substantial improvement on the current system where the donations registers are not on our website. You have to come into the council and look at them. So by picking up the register at November 29 and publishing it in a report, we permanently place it on the record and place it available on the website, because some of our things like the Register of Interests are also not available on the website. It's not a very helpful use of technology to observe this information. So the report on November 29 will make that an improvement. The 1.1.1.4 has the three dates when the register is updated. So October 3 is chosen because it's one day before the ballots go out, and it's 10 days after we know who all the candidates are. So there's an ability for communication to all candidates, and then for any information that is to be disclosed is disclosed on October 3, the first opportunity before the ballots go out. Obviously, quite a bit of campaign financing goes on during the campaign, so you need to then have one before Election Day, which picks up more updated material. So October 14 is 7 days before. And then, of course, quite a few donations come in afterwards, so you have a November 11 date for an update, and that will give you a comprehensive, hopefully, a comprehensive look at all donations, as opposed to a system that could be gamed by donations that are delayed and then never disclosed through this particular disclosure mechanism. 1.1.5 is also a loophole closing device where we're encouraging candidates and councillors to disclose the value, the collective value of any donations below the $500 threshold. So if someone goes around and solicits 100 donations of $499, under this motion, they would be disclosing the collective value of that. So that picks that up. And then 1.1.6 also picks up the question that I think Councillor Watts is referring to before, which is a self-funded campaign. So at the moment, there is quite a gap in the disclosure system with a self-funded campaign. And I think there's nothing wrong with a self-funded campaign. It's far better than a developer-funded campaign or any other third-party funded campaign. So this shock and horror about self-funded campaigns I'm a little surprised about, given the comparison with other campaigns. But this will pick that up because we're encouraging disclosure of self-funding, whether paying for a print bill or cash. So it's comprehensive, it's detailed, because this is a very complex area and you need to get it right. You need to try and pick everything up. We acknowledge openly that it's voluntary, so any candidate or any councillor can ignore this. But I would suggest they ignore it at their peril, because I think there will be some attention on this, and I think that councillors who work on one of the most open and transparent councils in Australia will get credit for this device and for cooperating with it, as would candidates. The legalities are also tricky. We're potentially in breach of the caretaker provisions if we publish material about candidates. So after consulting with the officers, and I think, Councillor Watts, it is important to consult with the officers on the legals, I've got the different approach, which is to write to the local government minister seeking for permission for us to do this on our website. And this will be an interesting test of the minister's approach to transparency and campaign financing. Is she going to tell us it's illegal to be super transparent during a campaign? I hope not. If she does tell us that, then the officers are authorised to seek a neutral, independent, third-party publishing body, which might be the Municipal Association of Victoria or the Local Government Association of Victoria. And in case there are any other complexities in this, we get an officer report back to the August Council meeting outlining the detail, such as the format of the table, the templates, the communication plan with candidates, and sorting of the issue of whether we can host the register or whether a third party can host the register. And the officers will also come up with any other legalities or technicalities in that, where politicians making a decision without officer formal advice, which is what we're doing tonight, formal written advice, if we are in any difficult territory, it will be picked up, hopefully, in that subsequent officer report. So I hope that councillors can support this as an unprecedented and comprehensive and hopefully bulletproof voluntary system of disclosure, which will build public confidence and provide timely information to voters in a level playing field approach, applying to councillors and all candidates equally.
Thank you, Councillor. I'll reserve the right to speak as seconder. Is there a further speaker to the debate? Councillor Wood.
No, Lord Mayor, seconding. I'm more than happy to support this. I think it's an excellent step. I think when you look at the comprehensive nature of the motion, I agree. I think it's a really good thing to seek advice and see how this might progress in terms of the legality. So I think that's excellent. I think given media interest, this is probably as mandatory as voluntary gets in terms of the disclosure. And, you know, I really do hope the message gets through to state government, to federal government, and indeed to other councils that this move is, I think, unprecedented in terms of disclosure. I think Councillor Mayne's worked on transparency and governance and continually pushing that and working with officers to deliver such a transparent council is there as a fantastic track record. I will put on the record right now in this meeting that I would have no issue whatsoever in complying with the directive of this motion. Once all the legals and the sort of process stuff are worked through, I think it's an excellent step. I'll again acknowledge the work. Yeah, if I ran. I'm not declaring I'm running. I would have no problems in complying with this. Councillor Oak. I will also again acknowledge Councillor Watt's work over a period of time in pushing this issue. So I think we've arrived at the right place where the Chair of Finance and Governance has put his hat on and really worked through all the ins and outs and delivered a motion which I'm more than happy to support.
Thank you. Is there a further speaker to the debate? Councillor Watts.
Yes. Just I would like to support this motion, but it is from a position of some dismay that it's been suggested that I didn't seek officer advice on this. I did. I would like to say that the opportunity to amend my motion had been there for a week, and this improved motion, and I'm readily acknowledged that it is a better one, only came out today. It's a very good motion. It takes us a long way down the road to where I would want us to end up. It's not quite there as far as I'm concerned, but there's room for improvement. It's certainly a lot better than we've had. It still remains, doesn't it, the issue of what type of donation, from what industry the donations are received from. Let's hope something can be done about that at some point. In the meantime, the constituents of Melbourne are going to be better informed when they start to vote at the next election. And a very good point that my colleague, Councillor Mayne, has brought out, that many campaign donations are not registered until sometimes after the election, and this particular motion picks that up. That's very important, and I'm pleased to have that in there. Thank you.
Is there a further contribution to debate? Councillor Pinder-Mortimer.
As usual, Councillor Mayne, you've been thorough and really quite very collegiate with this approach. He sought views throughout the day and was meticulous in taking on board officer advice as well. So I'm totally supportive of this amendment and acknowledge Councillor Watt's role in bringing this forward and commend Councillor Mayne's solid efforts in his refinement process of the original motion.
Thank you. Further contribution? Does the mover wish to conclude debate? In that case, I'll put the motion. All those in favour? That is unanimous. Thank you. Could I move to notice of motion 7.2, standing in Councillor Wood's name, and could I ask Councillor Wood to move the motion standing his name?
So moved, Lord Mayor.
Is that seconded? Councillor Oak, thank you. Councillor Wood.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I sort of don't think I have to go on too long about the Melbourne Metro project, 39,000 additional passengers in the peak. A much-needed project, which has been a priority project in all sorts of documents for the City of Melbourne. Indeed, even in our structure plans, Arden Macaulay and the various structure plans have actually built entire communities around the design of the Melbourne Metro project. An interesting stat, though, which always hits home, I sort of couldn't find the exact figures on this in the various websites, but the six-car trains that we have at the moment carry about 1,500 passengers in the crush, the peak crush. If you were very generous and put the equivalent length of cars on the road and filled them to capacity, you'd probably be looking at about 50 people being moved. So, you know, any leading city around the world is looking at mass transit to reduce congestion, to provide those viable alternatives as we seek to bring less cars into the city. Obviously, combining that with things like high-capacity signalling, we run about 16 trains an hour on our network due to the signalling capacity. We could run about 30. So this has to be combined with all sorts of other initiatives, level crossings, integration with our tram network, our bus network and the like. The issue we've got is that it's now 2016. We've got a project which has been Infrastructure Australia's high-priority project for a very long time. Been proposed in 2008, and since then we've seen many road projects get off the ground, in fact be delivered. And in fact, we just saw this announcement of $10 million committed to a project which is close to $11 billion in value. Over $1 billion in road projects was committed at exactly the same time. The reason given was the need for a fuller business case and the mention of value capture. My understanding that this business case is very developed in terms of a major infrastructure project, and indeed value capture is something which I would wholeheartedly support. And indeed, we commissioned through Councillor Oak a study by University of Melbourne into value capture. But the issue with value capture, there's four different forms of it, is that sort of the less impactful form would deliver about $1 billion to an $11 billion project. So regardless of things like value capture, there's still going to need to be a considerable investment by the federal government and indeed by the state government, and yes, potentially by value capture as well. So what this motion does is really talks to the federal government about getting serious about this project, put on the table some serious money and allow this project to start to implement the full business cases you see in blue there. Again, I think the road versus rail debate is an unfortunate one to have, but it keeps on getting ignited when we have announcements of $10 million for Melbourne Metro Rail and, as I said, over $1 billion for various road projects at the same time. The other thing about value capture is that it isn't some magic bucket of money, is people pay for that, and that comes from businesses, from residents, from those people who are perceived to actually derive value from the project. So it's not just some magic bucket of money. So again, having a significant commitment from the federal government, who receive our income taxes and various other taxes, we've got our businesses here paying land tax, we've got residents paying rates, there is people paying for all sorts of services. We need that huge federal government injection. A couple of other projects, London Cross Rail, LA are doing 30 years of mass transit in 10 years by various forms of investment as well. I think when you talk about the world's most livable city, we must have the Melbourne Metro project built and built as quickly as possible for that extra capacity. But we shouldn't be thinking about just the Melbourne Metro project. We should be funding the Melbourne Metro project, getting on with Doncaster Rail, getting on with Airport Rail, getting on with Roeville Rail, and ensuring that we've got a metro system which is commensurate with our title as the world's most livable city.
Councillor Oak.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thank you, Councillor Wood. There's quite a lot of disappointment in decisions that are made that affect our city that we somewhat don't have control over, and so I appreciate Councillor Wood putting forward this frustration through way of notice of motion on this topic. We could be here, every week with a list of these, decisions that really don't take into consideration all levels of government, and especially a project such as this that the City of Melbourne has been championing and supporting for its extremely long history. I understand your frustration and share it, that the recent announcement didn't reflect the real need for this project in the city, and acknowledge, obviously, the state government in bringing it forward as a project that needs to be completed for economic uplift, amongst many other things within the City of Melbourne. So I support your analysis of why we need to be requesting support from the feds, and I will write a letter. I'm not sure how well it will be received, but I will write it on behalf of all council, and maybe that provides a little bit more imprimatur rather than just from the Chair of Transport. But I certainly support all points that you raise, but in particular at 1.2, calling on all levels of government to work together. And I believe the City of Melbourne has delivered considerably to this project and will so in the future by way of some extraordinary staff that we have here who are working with the city, with the state government, and have done for many years before, and will do so until it's been completed. So our contribution from the city is certainly quite large, but I'm sure that we can always do more. But anyway, support the motion.
Further contributor debate? Councillor Mayne.
I too was disappointed. I thought Abbott to Turnbull was going to lead to some rail investment, and $10 million in the budget was frankly a joke. And when you consider the locked box approach to the east-west money, and the Turnbull and the Transport Minister Darren Chester still trying to push that project, which is officially not supported, Victoria's down to 9% of federal infrastructure funding. So it's very disappointing. Absolutely no support for the $5 billion Western Distributor, which is a 1970s LA spaghetti junction of flyovers to be wholly funded by motorists and the state, with not a dollar from the feds. So we're getting an absolutely incredibly raw deal from Canberra right now on infrastructure spending, with 100% funded toll road extension with the Western Distributor and $10 million for studies into Metro Rail. So City of Melbourne needs to continue advocating. I thank Councillor Wood for putting this up. It's very important to keep the pressure on. We do need to fire off a strong letter. $3 billion, I think, is almost undercooking it on a $10 billion in a city building, once-in-a-century project. It's absolutely vital that we get on with it. We'll also possibly need to refine our position as a council about specific value capture issues for landowners within our boundaries, but that's possibly a debate for another day. For now, we should strongly support this motion.
Further speaker to debate? Mover wish to conclude? In that case, we'll put the motion. All those in favour? That is unanimous. Thank you. Notice 7.3 is notice of motion standing in Councillor Mayne's name, asking to move that motion.
So move, Lord Mayor.
Is there a seconder for that motion? Deputy Lord Mayor, Councillor Mayne.
Lord Mayor, this is just a motion to approve a non-council funded trip to Perth later in the week for a breakfast presentation at the City of Vincent to 50 or so Perth councillors, telling the City of Melbourne story on openness in government and transparency. So no cost to council, and it's nice that other states are interested in hearing the City of Melbourne story on our transparency program. City of Perth had a few issues with a stinging report from their anti-corruption watchdog on some undisclosed travel by the Lord Mayor over there, and some other issues. And there is a mood for change in Perth, and they're looking to Melbourne, and this trip will hopefully help inform them on some of the things that we've done, including what we've done tonight on campaign finance.
Deputy Lord Mayor?
No, Lord Mayor.
Just further speaker to debate? In that case, I'll put the motion. All those in favour? That is unanimous. Thank you. Item 7.4 is a notice of motion standing in Councillor Oak's name. Could I ask Councillor Oak to move that?
So moved.
Is there a seconder? Councillor Wood. Thank you, Councillor Oak.
It is as it is. I thank the Nelson Mandela Commemorative Committee for writing a letter to myself, and I believe you, Lord Mayor, requesting that the City of Melbourne formally recognise Nelson Mandela Day on the 18th of July. And in particular, on that day, they've asked that the City of Melbourne think of ways that we can encourage Melburnians to devote 67 minutes of their time helping others, whereby that 67 minutes recognises Nelson Mandela's 67 years of public service. So I think it's a really nice idea, and I think there are a lot of programs and projects that we're involved in at the City of Melbourne that would probably classify as encouragement of our community to give back to others through public service. This could have been just done behind closed doors, but because of their request that we formally recognise Nelson Mandela Day, which is a UN-sanctioned day on the 18th of July, this is why I brought the motion. But at 1.2, I do ask that officers work with the Nelson Mandela Commemorative Committee rapidly, because I note that it'd be great to have some things that we can help advertise or support before this year's event. So to have a list of opportunities provided to discuss with the committee by the 26th of April, which is why 1.2 is there. But I doubt there will be very difficulty in finding events that we can support to honour Nelson Mandela and his service. So I recommend other councillors support this fairly obvious notice of motion.
Thanks to Councillor Oake for bringing this forward. I think to celebrate a man of the stature of Nelson Mandela is something that comes pretty easily. I do hope that in 1.2 that we do have a whole range of opportunities that we can discuss supporting. So thank Councillor Oake again for bringing this.
No, only to... I said no, but yes, I do that all the time. I'm sorry. No.
In that case, I will put motion all those in favour. Thank you. Those opposed, thank you. Seeing none, I'll declare the motion carried.
I'd like to move an amended motion by deleting point 1.2 and just having it as 1.1. Thanks, Lord Mayor. Look, I called this one in through a motion because it was City of Melbourne that recommended some reforms to the Municipal Association of Victoria about the way they receive motions from council. What would happen historically is that you just get 80 motions sight unseen quite close to the State Council, and then you've got to wrestle with when does council deliberate on them, how do we vote. So we proposed some changes to the timing, one of which was that motions lodged early were sent out to councils early. For further refinement, people can suggest amendments, generally debate them, and then have further time to say, oh, this agenda is missing a whole bunch of very important issues, let's put up a motion on this because it's currently not covered. I was a little disappointed that the MAV hadn't put these early motions on their website, so we put it on our website at 2 p.m. last Thursday when the agenda went up, and that was the main purpose of calling this in. We're not going to go through line by line telling other councils what's right or wrong with their motions. It was more just a publishing thing. Our motions are listed at 22 and 23. One is to support the idea of a federal ICAC, and the other one is some reviewing some exorbitant increases in VCAT fees when councils prosecute people. Discouraging us from actually doing prosecutions because of the exorbitant cost now at VCAT. So the motions are here to be seen. We're not going to comment on them specifically. It's just another example of hopefully a process reform and some transparency with early release of relevant information for the public and other councils.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, councillors, men and women of Old Melbourne Town. I applaud Councillor Rowan Lippitt for bringing forth this issue in regards to the Coriamba citriodora lemon-scented gum trees in Flemington Road. This is part of the Melbourne story. When we come back from overseas and travel back into the city, one of the first trees that we see in the city of Melbourne are these magnificent eucalypts. And the eucalypt is unique to Australia, and these trees have immense heritage value. In 1846, William Hooker, the first director of the Kew Royal Botanic Gardens, in an expedition in northern Australia, identified these trees and named them trees, Coriamba citriodora. I'm sure the Wurundjeri have a very good idea of this tree as well, and it goes back a bit further with their relationship with the tree. Now, with the city telewinding project, eastbound, you're looking at the same number of lanes will be used for the City Tunnel widening project as we already have. So there's no reason to have these trees removed. So again, I support council officers for the diligent work that they've done to sort of provide the information in regards to this, and for Councillor Leppett too for bringing forth this motion. Now, with these trees, you might be familiar with Bezisto's eucalyptus oil. The state government botanist back in the 19th century encouraged Bezisto to sort of cultivate eucalypts for the cultivation of essential oils. And that's a Melbourne story. So again, these trees represent part of the Melbourne story of like eucalypt oil. So again, kudos to Councillor Leppett for bringing this motion forward. So yeah, in conclusion, these trees are resilient. We know that the temperature is rising, and we know that it's going to be rising even further probably. That's what's being anticipated. So these trees are native trees, and they will be resilient to further increase in the temperature, so we should preserve them. So thank you, Councillor Leppett.
Mr. Mayor and councillors, I support wholeheartedly this initiative by Councillor Leppett. It's endorse the remarks of the previous speaker. Councillor Leppett deserves support from his fellow councillors to ensure that all options or alternatives for retaining all the trees and the feasibility of recalibrating the works are investigated with a view to retaining the trees. We ask that Council bring its considerable engineering expertise and resources to bear on the problem to help devise the best solution for pedestrians, cyclists and vehicles from the proposed widening works. Council is not entitled to give away any of its rights or powers, but holds them in trust for the protection and welfare of the community. There are times when Council must stand up for the community and the environment. This is the essence of local government. You have a duty to secure the best outcome for your community. Surely recent history shows that representing the greater public good involves bringing to account those who would ride roughshod over the welfare and peace of mind of the community in pursuit at any cost of their own strategic objectives. Will you rise to the challenge? Are you going to side with the roadmaker in a single determination to clear the earth of all vegetation for the sake of yet another freeway? Or are you going to protect the environment and devise a solution to an engineering challenge which will preserve the living heritage of the city and respond to the concerns of those who have put their faith in proper process and reasonableness in decision making? Council cannot stand by and refuse to intervene to the unreasoning exercise by another authority of a function which impacts so seriously on the welfare of its community. Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Mayor and Councillors, for hearing me. I was speaking for Protectors of Public Lands Victoria. It's a coalition of community groups formed to defend environmental heritage sites of significance, and we regard the tree or the line of trees as of significance, particularly the 90-year-old tree inscribed on the National Trust Register of Significant Trees. We support the statement made by the motion by Councillor Rowan Leppett and Joe Edmonds' statement. We have pointed out here that there's been virtually no consultation about the matter, and it was sprung on the community. We consider it most regrettable, and this is my main point, that the City of Melbourne should not have asked for a redesign of the project at the entrance of Flemington Road. This is given the City's record of the excellent streetscapes improvement program and the outstanding urban forest strategy, which mapped over 77,000 trees throughout the city. It was implemented in 2012. The urban forest visual, created by architect and data visualisation specialist Professor Greg Moore, provides information on each tree's botanical identity, location, health and its life expectancy. Hence, we cannot understand why, given this regard for the importance of Melbourne's trees, the City of Melbourne should not have protested about the axing of this significant tree and indeed the whole line of trees in Flemington Road. Under the Urban Forest Strategy, there is assigned, there is what is rather a zany email a tree program, and Councillor Aaron Wood has reported that it's extraordinary that people have emailed trees, thousands and thousands of emailed trees, and this interaction has revealed the love of Melbourne's have for their trees. Just to finish off, the lemon-scented gum in Flemington Road has an identity number, of course they all have, and a Melbourne cyclist wrote about the tree, "I admire your spectacular trunk every time I ride past. I wish there were more of you along Flemington Road." And the tree responded, I would also love if there were more of my cousins in the neighbourhood. This is a quote in the National Trust citation. Okay.
I hope it's all right if Dr. Anne Reid also presents at the same time, because we're kind of taking turns on the slide. Sorry, my name's Christine West, and I'm a resident in the vicinity of the tree. In fact, just metres from the tree and the intersection.
And I'm Anne Reid, and I've been living there not since 1994, but since 2000. I've owned property, but when I was a student way back in the 60s, I also lived in the area. So I've had 20 plus years living there. As residents, we had a letter delivered 2 working days before the proposed work started. 2 working days. There was no consultation, no options were offered. I had contacted the project people because they wanted to give reports of the house. And this is way back in September. I contacted them a number of times. "Oh, no, 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 there'll be no works outside your place. We're just doing these reports because we may have to relocate services, but there'll be no work east of Boundary Road." So that's what I was told. So it was all denied until we received the letter 2 days before.
Okay. I don't know how to do this. Okay. All right. So what we're saying is that as far as we can see, as mere residents, as there's no extra car lanes going in that section, there's really enough room to relocate the bike path, which is the main change. And in the literature that's published by the CityLink Teller, they've sort of stated that the reason for the works, well, this part of the works, is to stop the weaving of traffic in that section of road. But they say themselves that all inbound, sort of city-bound traffic have to decide early whether they're going into the centre carriageway or the outer to Elliott Avenue. So there's really no reason twice for people to be weaving in that section. So there's no reason to be getting rid of a median strip there. And you can see it on this next one here. I've overlaid the Google Maps, you know, terrain with the plans from CityLink Teller. And you can see I've outlined the existing curbs in the yellow lines. So you can see where the clash is with the lanes coming in off the Flemington ramp, curving around. And it's hard to see, but there is still two lanes this side of the big tree and three lanes that side. And the only extra thing that needs to fit is the new green bike lane, which is a great new thing so that bike riders can cross safely at the lights and continue all the way down Flemington Road. So, what was I going to say? So, anyway, I've taken a photo of the sidewalk, which is huge, and I'm saying, well, look at all this extra space that can be used to just create a little bit of extra room for that bike lane in the vicinity of the tree. Like, to me, it's sort of a no-brainer that there's plenty of room.
So, well, are these trees important? Well, they're just beautiful trees, and they really add beauty to the area. And even I was standing out to wave to the Queen when she came down the road to the Children's Hospital, and much to my surprise, instead of looking at me and my dogs, she loves dogs, she's pointing to Phil at the lovely trees in front of her. And I was only about 3 metres from her. So with these trees for overseas people, as you stated, are extremely important coming down that freeway there into Flemington Road. And also, because we live actually in the area, they give a shade in the afternoon. They give a shade in the front garden where we entertain. And more importantly, if you're a public transport user, when you stand on that tram stop, there is no other shade apart from those trees in the middle of the day. So they're very
And I've taken some photos. So this was sort of late afternoon, I think. And you'll see that the canopy of the tree covers 5 lanes of traffic and shades it as well, and it's just irreplaceable, really. In the evening, it covers the entire intersection, and that is just from the big tree. It's not from any other local trees on the side of the road. And, oh, sorry, wrong way again. sorry. The tram stop. So that's showing midday sun shading that tram stop. Flemington Bridge tram stop there. Right.
So there's been a few crashes. Yes. Okay. So one of the things is that cars come through the red lights, and so to have a median strip there, you can jump onto the median strip, which I've had to do.
Yes. And I'll just add that as a person that lives right on that intersection, I hear the crashes. I'm home all the time. I run out and it's always drivers running the red light. I think I've probably heard at least 12 crashes, as quoted by City Teller, and the last one that had 3 injuries. I heard that and I went out and it was a driver running the red light coming down off the freeway. Nothing to do with the tree.
Thank you very much, ladies.
Hi, thank you again for the opportunity to address you tonight. I don't want to repeat too much of what's already been said about these fantastic trees, except to say and reiterate that this group of trees is really the gateway to the capital of the Garden State, and we shouldn't forget that. Thousands of people admire it every day as they leave the freeway to enter Flemington Road, and it beautifies an otherwise unremarkable entrance to the city. It provides shade in summer as you wait for the lights to change, and on sunny days you can smell its citrus aroma if you put down the window, much nicer than automobile fumes. To give a little bit more background about the primary tree that we're talking about, that's on the significant tree register of the Trust, it's about 100 years old. It's clearly visible in historic photos as a mature specimen in the 1930s, so we believe it's a very early example of using a lemon-scented gum as a street tree. It was first recorded by the Trust in 1982, and it's recognised at a regional level for its contribution to the landscape and its aesthetic qualities. And yet there are no council overlays that protect this tree, despite, as Julian spoke about earlier, the city's fantastic commitment to protecting trees in the city. It also seems that this decision to remove the trees was made before any public consultation. The Trust began a petition online on Friday, and since the petition was launched, over 1,000 people have signed their support to save this significant tree. You only need to read the hundreds of comments on that petition to see the many and varied reasons that so many people appreciate this tree. And I'll just read out a couple of them, because I think sometimes in considering strategic issues, we overlook the human experience. Rod Dunstan says, "No matter whether the tree goes or not, commuters will still wait at the lights. If the tree stays, at least they can choose to look at a beautiful tree, older than all of us, and not the taillights of the car in front." The National Trust strongly supports Councillor Leppett's motion to refuse permission for the removal of the lemon-scented gums, and for Council to seek further information regarding this removal. We simply don't believe that the CityLink Tulla Widening Project has adequately demonstrated that there are no other feasible options. We therefore call on councillors to do whatever they can to prevent the removal of this beloved century-old tree. Thank you.
So I move. Thank you, Lord Mayor. Gateway to the capital of the Garden State. I can't do any better than that. That's poetry, Felicity. Thank you. There's been overwhelming support from particularly the local community for getting this issue aired, as has been identified today and as has been identified in the last 10 days or so. The notice that's been given to the residents that immediately abut Flemington Road was 2 working days. The Tulla Widening Authority can say that they've been consulting for a very long time. However, the generalist glossies that have been going to local residents are not the same thing as telling residents who live just metres from a tree that their tree is about to be removed. So there's been overwhelming support, and it's been a pleasure to meet so many new people in that wonderful Parkville West community in particular. Submitters today have done a remarkable job at explaining why the tree is so important to that local community. It must be at least 94 years old. Twitter's now one of my research tools of choice, and I think Anna from the National Trust has replied to one of my tweets showing a photo from 1930. Aaron, you were copied in. Councillor Wood, I beg your pardon. Copied in. Showing that the tree was already mature, and provided that shading, beautiful community central role back in 1930. And that was when the Flemington Road was actually being expanded, the number of lanes, and even then the lanes were going around that tree to make sure that that spectacular tree in 1930 was retained. Anyone on Twitter, just jump online, have a look. I recommend it. There's already been pictures as well about the shade. The urban heat island effect in this part of Melbourne, and as in all parts of Melbourne, is something that all governments need to be acutely aware of and mitigate against. There is a huge expanse of bitumen already at the Flemington Road intersection, and the increase of the number of lanes coming off the freeway from the current 2 to 5, and then you add the other two lanes veering off to go down Boundary Road, and that's only on one side of Flemington Road. If you consider all the stuff happening on the south side, the expanse of bitumen is just going to get larger and larger. The urban heat island effect is getting worse if you don't retain and promote as much shade as possible, and so there are very real community health issues that need to be considered, as well as traffic safety issues. Another issue that's been considered as well, and very briefly mentioned tonight in passing, was that the tree and the median strip currently provides residents who are crossing Flemington Road with a safe haven on the way to the tram stop. That is a safety consideration that has to be taken into consideration, as well as traffic safety. Five lanes is actually a bit too many to guarantee a safe walk across the Flemington Road for elderly residents. Pollution and noise mitigation, community symbols, there are a whole lot of issues, but they've been talked about tonight. It's only today that I, for the first time, saw drawings come through from the CityLink Tunnel Widening Authority. I can't disclose what's in detail what's been discussed at a session that wasn't open to the public, but I've requested a few times for as much detail as possible to know that the City of Melbourne has applied its tree retention removal policy to its absolute, given the significance of this tree, and I've sought details about the alternative options that have been abandoned by CityLink Tulla to get to the proposal that they formally got on the table at the moment. And it was only today that I first saw some drawings. However, those were 2 years out of date. The lanes coming off Mount Alexander Road were eastbound, were five lanes, not four, and there have been no drawings, as to the best of my knowledge. This is just an assertion of mine, challenging an assertion of Vic Roads and the Tulla Widening Authorities. To my very best knowledge, and I'm quite sure of this, the authority or Vic Roads has not put together drawings and adequately modelled an option that would include the retention of at least the very eastern end of the existing median strip, which of course has that most significant National Trust listed gum on it. I'm sure that we have to lose probably half the majority of the median strip, but I remain completely unconvinced that there is not a design solution available to the Tulla Widening Authority. In consultation with any traffic experts and engineering experts who can provide the advice, whether from the City of Melbourne or otherwise, which can retain the tree. There are three or four options that have arisen after the briefing that we had from the Tulla Widening Authority today, which I would like the Tulla Widening Authority to explore, and they haven't had the chance to do that yet. So just briefly in closing, the Tulla Widening Authority has not done their job properly. Consultation is, you can assert that you've consulted, but it's not good enough to not give the details of what the proposal is until 2 days before the removal of the tree and more than a year, basically, after the decision was made. The list of community groups that the authority asserted they consulted with included Parkville Gardens Residents Association, but not the Parkville Residents Association, so not even the Residents Association that covers the residents that live in the area. So there's a lot of corners that I believe have been cut. I know it's a big claim, but I do think this is a case of lazy public policy making, and that we have not explored the alternatives and not explored design options that retain this magnificent tree. And because of its value, we must explore those options before the Tulla Widening Authority's assertion can be proved to be correct. So far, their assertions have not been proved to be correct, and so the tree, for now, must remain.
Councillor Wood.
I agree completely. I think the submitters were fantastic. You essentially said all that needs to be said, but I think any tree that has the Queen's blessing in effect deserves to be protected. I think Councillor Lippert's made the comments really well in terms of the specifics about the plan and looking at alternative designs. Just a wider comment sort of about open space and trees, in that they're always seen as places to stick things, and yet all the policies of forward-thinking cities like the City of Melbourne point to doubling forest canopy cover, increasing open space by 24 hectares, and yet they're the very sites that we choose to sort of put infrastructure like this. And that's both road and rail. That's not discerning between either. And that what we should be looking at is these great areas of open space, of greenery, of street trees, like these lemon-scented gums, and saying we should be doing everything possible to protect them. And I think Councillor Leppard's motion is a good one in that we should be thinking very deeply and very intelligently about everything we can do to avoid cutting them down in the first instance. The other thing I'll talk about too is just in terms of the wider context of this is latent demand, and that is the more we make roads easier to drive on, the less people are likely to jump on public transport. And it's glaringly obvious that with a lot of these road projects, although very necessary for people travelling from the outer suburbs, and indeed the numerous trips that I make every year to the airport, I see it happening. So no doubt, yes, there's a need for this. But where is the bloody airport rail? You know, I mean, when you talk about things that have been around for a very long time, this is one of those projects which takes demand and uses that important real estate of our roads for much more applicable things, whether that's moving things like freight around or other sorts of initiatives like that. The other thing, the last comment I want to make in support of this motion is the amount of work that Councillor Leppard has done in bringing this motion to us. Not only does he read every single document that comes out from Council, but he then takes it upon himself to door knock residents and find out for himself what was going on with the consultation part of this project. So you certainly can't underestimate the work he puts in on behalf of City of Melbourne and on behalf of residents. So I'm more than happy to support this. I do want to put the caveat that we may not get the result that we want. That's just the way these things are. But what should be happening here is that every avenue should be looked at to redesign this to retain trees of such significance, and we hope that we may be able to see a good result in protecting a tree like this.
Further contribution to debate? Councillor Watts.
Very, very briefly, it seems to me that it's a miracle that's still there, given the pressure from roads. And but a point that came out tonight for the first time, I think, is that we had these people come and discuss this matter with us today, and there was a lot of talk about the safety aspects. But tonight, the safety for pedestrians came out, which is not something that I recall in the presentation today. But the bottom line is really aesthetic, isn't it, and cultural and heritage. So all of the arguments that we made earlier could be applied to this very, very special set of trees. And I'm confident, I'm optimistic that a design solution can be found. It has to be.
Further contribution to debate? Okay, so I'll make a very brief one. I want to thank our submitters tonight, and two of them, I think, encapsulated what it is that we have to examine. First, Joe, thank you for your contribution about an engineering challenge. And that doesn't mean a fait accompli. It means looking at potential design solutions. And Christine put her finger on the issue that will need to be addressed when she talked about lane change. Because they're the arguments that have been made to us, not to diminish the contribution of other speakers who talked about the social, environmental and emotional importance of these trees. I am not yet convinced that the authority has looked at the appropriate balance between the argument they make about safety, which is the lane change argument that Christine talked about, and the importance of maintaining such critical trees to the City of Melbourne. And I think, thanks to Councillor Leppard, and I echo Councillor Wood's comments about Councillor Leppard's contribution here, I think that we need to press them to look more closely at the design solutions that may meet the engineering challenges that Joe outlined. But again, I echo what both Councillor Leppard and Councillor Wood have said. This is a balancing act for us around influence. The final decision may not be ours. On projects like this, we can be directed to issue a work order by the state government. So I would encourage those people who presented to us tonight to make equal representation to the state government in order to make sure that these issues are properly considered. As I said, I'm not yet convinced that the work has been done on trying to overcome the engineering challenges. Safety, of course, is going to be paramount, absolutely paramount. But if there is a solution which allows particularly this very important tree to remain, then that will be a good solution all around, and that's why I'm pleased to support Councillor Leppard's motion tonight. Is there a further contribution to debate? Mover wish to conclude debate? In that case, I'll move the motion. All those in favour? That is unanimous. Thank you. That concludes the items of general business. Any items of urgent business? Are there any questions the public would like to ask us at the conclusion of this meeting? In that case, could I thank staff and members of the public for their interest in attendance and declare the meeting closed at 7 minutes to 8 p.m.